From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, my guests are Peter Salama and Annalise Borrell. They will be discussing public health in Afghanistan and the slow process of development in the setting of a quarter century of war. Then, we'll be joined by Kevin Concannon, the architect of the main drug program, which will provide drug discounts to the over 300,000 citizens in Maine who do not have prescription drug insurance coverage. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month that the program violates no laws and can be implemented as designed. Finally, I'll be providing a commentary on the importance of Maine's program, as well as a major achievement at the World Health Organization last month. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. And an analysis that appeared in the Washington Post. The World Health Organization has been granted broad new authority to fight global threats to public health, such as the severe acute respiratory syndrome, otherwise known as SARS. The World Health Assembly, which is the governing body of the World Health Organization, unanimously approved a resolution to allow the WHO to intervene even when countries refuse to admit that they are facing a health crisis. The changes are aimed at correcting the weaknesses exposed by the SARS epidemic and mark the first significant expansion of the World Health Organization's power since a set of rules guiding its actions were agreed upon in 1969. The action frees the World Health Organization from having to wait until a country officially reports an international health threat before beginning countermeasures, and it gives the agency the authority to begin ground inspections without a formal invitation. Until now, the World Health Organization could only respond to official government reports and had no power to independently verify whether containment efforts were adequate. In the case of SARS, China denied for months that the epidemic was raging in the southern province of Guangdong, allowing the dangerous new lung infection to spread around the world. Under the resolution approved, the World Health Organization can act on many other sources of information, including news accounts, reports from non-governmental health organizations such as the Red Cross, and from scientific laboratories. The World Health Organization can then alert the international community to the presence of a public health threat. The World Health Organization still has no power to punish a non-compliant nation, but during the SARS epidemic, it was successful in organizing international pressure to gain cooperation. And the World Health Organization demonstrated that alerts and travel advisories can have a devastating economic impact. The new rules also require that every nation establish a formal contact mechanism for communication between each country's public health authority and the World Health Organization during public health emergencies. According to the Washington Post, the U.S. delegation surprised officials at the conference by formally requesting a postponement of action. Later, however, the U.S. dropped the request for delay after it garnered no support, and the original proposal was endorsed by speaker after speaker. Attempting to explain why the U.S. delegation tried to delay the measure, Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, explained that he supports the concept of giving the World Health Organization more power, but wanted more time to determine whether increased authority might somehow interfere with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S. The U.S. move to delay perplexed delegates from other nations, since the measure had been widely circulated and discussed for weeks prior to the vote. Ultimately, the U.S., however, abandoned its delay effort and allowed the resolution to be passed unanimously. In 1999, the World Health Organization, for the first time in its history, convened a treaty negotiation to limit the spread of tobacco addiction into the poor countries of the global south. On May 21st, the World Health Organization completed that four-year-long negotiating process with the unanimous adoption of a document known as the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. This treaty commits nations to banning all tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. It requires large warning labels covering at least 30% of the cigarette package. The treaty also provides nations with a roadmap for enacting strong science-based policies in other areas, such as public education, tobacco cessation treatment, and protections from secondhand smoke in public places. It also sets standards for tobacco taxation and contains provisions to combat cigarette smuggling. Germany, Japan, and the U.S. attempted to weaken the final agreement, but the unity demonstrated by nearly every other nation was successful in generating a strong agreement. A more detailed report on the impact of the treaty and the diplomatic twists and turns that occurred during the final months of negotiation will air next month on Public Health Radio. The Texas House and Senate voted on June 1st to approve a budget bill that would reduce its expenditures on its child health insurance program. As a consequence of this budget measure, 170,000 children in Texas will lose health insurance coverage. The 300,000 or so children who remain eligible will face higher premiums and co-payments and will have poorer coverage. Parents of children enrolled in the child health program currently pay a small enrollment fee. They pay a $15 monthly premium, $10 or $20 co-pays for doctor visits, prescription drugs, and tests, and $50 for an emergency room visit or a hospital stay. All of these fees are set to increase under the new law. Coming up next, the public health crisis in Afghanistan. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In the autumn of 2001, just after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, the country of Afghanistan, far away in Central Asia, began to dominate news coverage in the United States. The U.S. government was providing air support for military groups which successfully fought to overthrow the Taliban regime. This was the second time that the U.S. government had been involved in supporting a war in that country. During the 1980s, the Reagan and Bush administrations had supported the largest covert operation in U.S. history to support the Mujahideen in their effort to oust the Soviet Union's forces from their country. After that successful effort, the country never stabilized, and civil wars have been ongoing since then. The U.S. and other Western countries were widely criticized at the time for abandoning Afghanistan and providing minimal redevelopment assistance. After the U.S. succeeded in overthrowing the Taliban in 2001, the Bush administration vowed that Afghanistan would not be abandoned a second time. Joining us today to discuss the public health crisis in Afghanistan is Annalise Borrell and Peter Salama. Peter Salama attended medical school in his native country of Australia and subsequently relocated to the U.S., where he studied public health at Harvard University and then served as an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the CDC in Atlanta. For nearly 10 years, he has devoted his career to the improvement of public health systems in some of the poorest countries of the global south. Since January 2002, Dr. Salama has served in Afghanistan as the Chief of Health and Nutrition for UNICEF Afghanistan. In that capacity, he is responsible for the design and implementation of UNICEF's largest health and nutrition program. Annelise Borel received her training in the field of public health and nutrition at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in 1993. Since then, she has worked in several countries of Africa, Asia, and in Kosovo as a nutrition advisor for the United Nations World Food Program, for the International Rescue Committee, and several other non-governmental aid organizations. Since October of 2001, she has worked with UNICEF in Afghanistan, where she currently serves as the Senior Food Security and Nutrition Advisor for the Afghani Ministry of Health, as well as UNICEF Afghanistan. On today's show, we'll hear the first part of that interview, and we'll be airing the remainder on next month's show. This interview was done via satellite phone from Kabul, and I'd like to warn listeners of the occasional breaks in transmission in the effort to record the interview. Regrettably, the interview could not be conducted in an interactive manner because my two guests had to share the only phone line available at the UNICEF office in Kabul. Peter Salama and Annelise Borel, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks, Marvin. Nice to be here.
Hi, Marvin. Thanks.
I'd like to start out by asking you to provide some recent history on what has occurred during the last 25 years in Afghanistan and how this tumultuous history has impacted the public health.
Well, as you know, Afghanistan has suffered a civil war for more than two decades. And it really started in the late 70s, where Afghanistan assumed a geopolitical importance during the Cold War. And in 1979, Soviet troops began an intense war with Mujahideen forces, who were supported by several Western countries. This war went well into the 1980s, when finally the Soviets withdrew in 1989. And then the civil war between the Mujahideen and other forces continued into the 90s. Overall, the war has had a devastating impact on the civilian population, with 1.5 million killed during the course of those two decades, and around 7 million people displaced from their homes, including 4.5 million refugees to surrounding countries, particularly Pakistan and Iran. It's well known that the Taliban, who were initially formed from religious scholars both in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The Taliban took control of the majority of the country beginning around 1994, and by 2000, 90% of the territory. And then finally, in recent memory, we've seen the collapse of the Taliban after the US-led military intervention beginning in 2001 after September 11th. And then with the fall of the regime towards the end of 2001. But since then, the war and the conflict is still going on, even though Kabul and certain urban centers have known some more peaceful times in the last 18 months. There are certainly still conflicts raging in parts of the country, and this definitely affects our ability to deliver aid in Afghanistan.
Women and children are typically the biggest victims of war. And perhaps you could tell us how the decades of military conflict have impacted maternal and child health in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan has really some very dramatic public health indicators. In terms of under five and infant mortality, Afghanistan has the worst infant and under five mortality rates in the world, and in fact the worst outside Africa. The major causes of death for children in Afghanistan are very preventable. Communicable diseases such as acute respiratory infection and diarrhea, as well as vaccine-preventable diseases, particularly measles. And these interact with malnutrition in a synergistic effect that causes very high mortality among children. Mm-hmm. When we talk about malnutrition in Afghanistan, we talk about three important forms of malnutrition. First of all, there's acute malnutrition, which are wasted children. You know, your listeners would think of images of Ethiopia at the moment. But that form of acute malnutrition is actually not very common in Afghanistan. What is far more important are chronic malnutrition or wasting, where kids are just, or stunting, where kids are just low height for their age, and micronutrient deficiencies. And these have a very important interactive relationship with communicable diseases by depressing the immune system. To give you one dramatic example, Afghanistan still suffers every winter time from very, very large outbreaks of vitamin C deficiency or scurvy that are virtually unknown in most parts of the world. In terms of other public health problems in Afghanistan, the really big issue is maternal mortality. A recent study done by UNICEF in conjunction with the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta will be released shortly, and it was conducted in four provinces of Afghanistan. And basically, if these rates that it shows for maternal mortality apply to the rest of the country, Afghanistan will have the highest maternal mortality in the world. Basically, 70 to 80% of the maternal deaths in Afghanistan were potentially preventable. Now, in terms of what we can do about these problems, we've had some very big successes this year in Afghanistan, despite the very difficult circumstances. One example is measles. Measles, unlike in developed countries, in Afghanistan and other developing countries, is a major killer of children. And it's estimated that around 30,000 children die every year in Afghanistan due to measles. In a massive campaign led by the Ministry of Health and supported by UNICEF, last year more than 10 million children were vaccinated for measles, which is 94% of the entire population of children between the ages of 6 months and 12 years. And that level of coverage is basically enough to interrupt measles transmission in Afghanistan. So there are major success stories as well as the difficulties in Afghanistan. And we need to do a similar thing on maternal mortality in terms of really prioritizing it as an issue. And the intervention there, of course, is very different. It's making services for women with pregnancy-related complications accessible. It's much more complex than an immunization program, and it will take many, many more years to see the same effect that we see with immunization programs, but it's no less important.
Well, Peter, why don't we talk about women's health then? After the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan and the war ended, I guess in approximately November or so of 2001, our administration actually indicated that now not only would terrorism be helped, but that the women of Afghanistan were now free. And I wonder if lesser rights that women have had in Afghanistan impact their use of health services, particularly potentially with foreign or male doctors.
It's very important to say from the beginning that it's virtually impossible to attribute the very difficult circumstances for women in Afghanistan and their high maternal mortality ratios to any one political regime in their history. It's certainly sure to say that the Taliban regime did not contribute by any means to alleviating the very difficult circumstances for women in Afghanistan. But it's also important to note that women's mortality and women's situation in Afghanistan was very poor prior to the Taliban regime. And even in areas that were never controlled by the Taliban in Afghanistan, maternal mortality ratios are extremely high. So this is a long-term problem related to culture, related to infrastructure and development, and clearly very much related to the level of education of women in this country. Now, to answer the question of whether things have improved dramatically for women since the change in political regime, I think it's safe to say that in urban settings, the situation has improved somewhat, but it's going to take many, many, many years and lots of development for the situation for women in Afghanistan to improve. And I think one of the most tangible rights that people tend not to think of when they talk about women's rights is a woman's right to care when she's pregnant and a woman's right not to have a 1 in 10 expectation of dying during pregnancy in the course of a lifetime. And that is currently the risk for women, the lifetime risk for women during pregnancy in Afghanistan.
And is contraception, is there availability of contraceptive care for women in Afghanistan?
Very few women have used any form of contraception, probably less than 5% nationally. Clearly this varies, this access to contraception from urban to rural settings. But overall, the use of contraception is extremely low in Afghanistan.
Is that a priority of international aid workers to help women with that?
Yeah, I think in terms of certain UN agencies such as UNFPA, United Nations Family Planning Association, they are certainly prioritizing this as their mandate in terms of improving access to contraception for women. And it's clear that with a maternal mortality ratio that is so high, that every pregnancy in Afghanistan unfortunately represents a risk to the mother. And if we're going to decrease maternal mortality in Afghanistan, it's going to require women to have carefully planned pregnancies as well as better access to emergency obstetric care.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. We've been speaking with Peter Salama and Annalise Borrell from the UNICEF office in Kabul, Afghanistan, about the public health crisis in that war-torn country. After the break, we'll hear about efforts to address mental illness and malnutrition in Afghanistan. Then later in the show, Kevin Concannon will be joining us to discuss the Maine drug discount program that will soon benefit 300,000 Maine residents who lack prescription drug insurance coverage. So stay tuned. For those who are just joining us, our guests today are Peter Salama and Annalise Borrell. Both Peter and Annalise are health workers involved in the redevelopment effort in Afghanistan. I would assume that after years of essentially nonstop war, post-traumatic stress and other mental health disorders must be rampant in Afghanistan. Can you tell us what's known about mental illness there and how the government and aid organizations are responding?
Yeah, Marvin, there is likely to be substantial mental health problems in Afghanistan. It's something that's actually extremely difficult to study because most of the tools that we have to study mental health on a population basis have been developed to suit Western cultures and Western mindsets and have been only validated, in fact, in Western countries. What we can say, though, is that there are extremely important stressors in Afghanistan, particularly for women, but clearly also for men, given the history of the warfare in the last 20, 25 years. And there is very likely to be significant mental illness in this population. In terms of care for mentally unwell patients, there are actually very limited resources in Afghanistan and very limited facilities that can deal either with the severest end of the spectrum, those with diagnosable mental health disorders, or even with less severe problems. And I think one of the most important challenges, in fact, for the international community here is to be able to develop a culturally acceptable, community-based mental health programs in Afghanistan that don't necessarily rely on only individual care as the only option.
I imagine that after a war has occurred, or years and years of war, that there must be problems with safe drinking water and perhaps contributing to some of the diarrhea and other communicable disease. And I was wondering if you could talk about that problem in Afghanistan.
Yeah, this is a really big issue in Afghanistan. As I mentioned earlier, diarrhea is one of the leading causes of under 5 mortality. And in fact, according to a recent study done again by CDC in conjunction with UNICEF, diarrhea is in fact the leading cause of mortality in this age group. And clearly that relates to the very poor access to safe drinking water and sanitation facilities that the majority of Afghans have. In fact, the data shows that around 17% of people in urban Afghanistan have access to safe drinking water and only around 3% in rural parts of the country. So this is a huge problem and certainly one that is recognized by agencies such as UNICEF that are prioritizing the building of tube wells for safe drinking water, of safe water points, and of sanitation facilities. One of the more interesting projects that's being planned at the moment is a joint project by CDC, PSI, Population Services International, based also in the US, and with some support from UNICEF, where we're actually looking not only at the water point itself, but also at the end user. So, for example, it's very easy to set up tube wells and pumps, But the problem is that water can then be contaminated all the way down the process right to the household level. So what this project chooses to focus on is within the household, making sure that the water storage system is safe and that the water can be disinfected at the household level. And this is really a very important aspect to ensuring a safe water distribution system within Afghanistan.
So how far along is the aid program and the government's effort there to provide safe water for everyone in Afghanistan?
It's really been gearing up only since early 2002, and it's still got many, many years to go before we could say that the majority of the population in Afghanistan will have safe drinking water. So it will require sustained support from the international donor community if we're going to really change these horrendous statistics.
For something like 3 or 4 years before Afghanistan pierced the U.S. media, there was an occasional report from Afghanistan of a drought. And I was wondering if you could comment on that drought. Is it over, and are there still implications on that for the current problems?
The drought, lasting about 3 to 4 years, has ended in most parts of the country. We do see, however, the drought continuing in the southern parts of the country. A reduction in wheat production was reported for the past 3 to 4 years, but has improved during this year. Obviously, this is not sufficient for the country, and the country still remains heavily dependent on food aid imports. The importation, the commercial importation of wheat has increased again this year as cash becomes more available in the country, but we still have serious concerns about the dietary diversity and the diverse foods, including pulses and oils, etc.
Well, why don't you get into that a little further? Are there any particular nutrients nutritional problems that are unique to Afghanistan, or any cultural issues?
Okay, as I said, throughout the drought, wheat was available. It was available where there was cash to purchase it. So in urban areas, wheat was available. It was just that rural populations lost their capacity to access it in where there were no markets. In terms of dietary diversity, this has been a chronic and endemic problem in Afghanistan. Generally, the Afghan population do not consume a diverse diet, but certainly in the last couple of years, we saw a dramatic decrease in the dietary diversity of people. A study done by Tufts University recently, last year, looked at dietary diversity over the last 3 years, and certainly we saw a dramatic decrease in people's consumption of milk and meat products during the last year. This also has a seasonal pattern for most of the populations who experience long winter seasons and become basically isolated from any markets. So purchase of vegetables on markets becomes impossible for a lot of the population. Obviously, during the drought, people have lost their livestock, particularly small livestock. This means loss of access to products, meat, and that means a lack of consumption of yogurt and cheese products, which is normally a large component of people's diets. Particularly, I think we would be concerned about the winter periods. As I said, many villages become isolated, inappropriate conditions for cultivating fruit and vegetables. So in terms of design of interventions, we'll also have to consider food processing, access to markets where people can purchase fruit and vegetables and other products, and obviously restocking of small livestock.
In terms of creation of markets, if people don't have the money to buy fruits and vegetables imported from other countries, how will the presence of a market help them?
Basically, what we are trying to encourage is interventions also address p- people's income opportunities. So certainly, while implemented on a small scale, we're hoping that income-generating projects, employment schemes, cash for work programs rather than food for work programs should be encouraged. So people, there is an increase of cash on the in the market system. So certainly, as long as people have access to a market, these programs should be more effective than just food distribution programs.
And how far along is that effort?
It's going to. It has begun, and certainly, I'm not quite sure of the figures, but certainly the World Bank is encouraging, largely through government structures, through a solidarity program, that a large proportion of the, I believe, 50% of the food value, rather than coming in food, should come in cash. But these programs obviously need careful monitoring and support as well.
We've been listening to the first of a two-part interview on the state of public health in Afghanistan, 18 months after the U.S.-supported war to overthrow the Taliban regime. On next month's show, we'll air the remainder of that interview, in which we'll focus on the availability of medical services, and also about the burden of physical disability the country faces due to the years of military conflict and the ongoing problem of death and injury that landmines are still causing in Afghanistan. Coming up next on today's show, Kevin Concannon is joining us to discuss the effort the state of Maine has made to reduce the cost of prescription drugs and the recent victory of their program in the final effort the drug manufacturers undertook to derail Maine's program in the U.S. Supreme Court. So stay tuned. Last month, the Supreme Court sided with the state of Maine in what may prove to be a landmark battle by state governments to lower prescription drug prices. Joining us today to discuss that lawsuit is Kevin Concannon. Mr. Concannon held the position of Commissioner of Maine's Department of Human Services from 1995 until February of this year, when he relocated to Iowa. In Iowa, he serves as the director of the Iowa Department of Human Services. Kevin Concannon, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Kevin, it's clear that under your direction, the state of Maine seemed to be at the forefront among all states in proposing a potentially effective strategy to address the problem of high prescription drug costs. Describe the magnitude of the problem of drug costs in the state of Maine.
Well, Maine, there are many factors that I think all helped and contributed to Maine's leadership and commitment to try to do something about access to affordable prescription drugs. First of all, as a state, it's a relatively poor state. It's 33rd or 34th in per capita income in the U.S., and it is bounded on the east and on the north by two Canadian provinces. That's very important in the whole debate around prescription drugs, largely because extended families in northern and eastern Maine who live on both sides of the border know firsthand that they can purchase the very same prescription drugs manufactured in Pennsylvania or Puerto Rico or New Jersey for less than half the cost on the U.S. side. And the companies aren't giving those medications away in Canada. They're still making a profit, but they're not making the rate of margin of profit that they make in the U.S. So the fact that in Maine, with a population of 1,300,000 people, had approximately 325,000 residents without any prescription drug insurance, a number of elderly people, but actually many people between the ages of 21 and 64 as well without a prescription drug insurance. So we had a need for many people to get access to them We had hundreds of thousands of people without prescription drug insurance. We had the experience of people being able to cross the border into New Brunswick or Quebec, being able to obtain these drugs at much less. And the state and the Medicaid program, the state and federal health insurance program for low and increasingly for the lower middle income populations, was witnessing double-digit increases in the prescription drug costs each year. The last year I was there in Maine, the Medicaid program spent $250 million on prescription drugs alone. So all of these factors tended to sort of elevate the issue of access and the need for a state to have a strategy around prescription drugs. When it came to my attention, as I became more and more aware of both the rising costs, the excessively rising costs, but also the gap in providing access, I actually had the pharmacy consultant in the Maine department explore whether we could import the 50 most commonly prescribed drugs from New Brunswick and bring them into a warehouse in Maine and then have them then in turn distributed to pharmacies across our state, if those pharmacies would promise to pass on the discount. And while we're excited about that as a plan, it turned out to be unworkable, largely because the pharmaceutical manufacturers have so influenced both Congress and the FDA to make it nearly impossible to reimport in bulk medications. And they do so under the guise of safety, arguing and scaring people that somehow they'll be threatened by less effective or counterfeit drugs or what have you. And yet I'm aware of the fact that last year I think there were an estimated some 12 million prescriptions that came across the border, across the whole United States, from Canada. I don't think there's a single example of a counterfeit or a weakened or, you know, a compromised medication. Yet that's the official public policy in the country because of the federal laws and the influence on the FDA by pharmaceutical manufacturers. So having been blocked really in terms of that direction, in Maine, a council of elders, that is a senior citizens lobby group led by a former union activist, really came up with the idea of what we came to call Maine RX, or the goal of creating a program where people could get a discount card or a card that would result in a discount of medication. And we as the state agency would negotiate with the manufacturers to obtain a discount similar to the Medicaid discount. I mentioned earlier that Maine had about 325,000 people without drug insurance, and also that people regularly bought individual prescriptions across the border into Quebec and New Brunswick for 40 to 50 to 60% less. We know that the Medicaid discount programs, the way in which the drug manufacturers reimburse state Medicaid programs across the country, the manufacturers provide back to the states a discount equal to that which they sell their medication at the best discount price. So typically I tend to think of the manufacturers giving probably the fullest discount to Kaiser Permanente, a very large West Coast-based HMO. And that typically runs in the 20 to 25%. So what happens is states pay for Medicaid prescriptions at the drugstore through their electronic payment systems. The states keep track of how many units of a particular medication are sold, and then on a quarterly basis, the drug manufacturers reimburse to the states the difference between what the state paid for that medication and the best price that that manufacturer provides, let's say in another part of the country. That's typically referred to as the Medicaid discount. So our goal in Maine RX was to try to make available that same Medicaid discount to residents of our state. And the way in which we did it was we wrote to all the manufacturers. I sent the letters to about 400 manufacturers and labelers of medications in the U.S. saying, here's our law, here's what we're trying to achieve, we would like to enter into an agreement with you. And only about 50 of the 400 actually wrote back and said, we'll enter into a contract with you. And they were generally the small companies, none of those so-called big pharma or large companies agreed to that. But the law provided that if those companies did not enter into an agreement with us, that we could subject their medication in the Medicaid program to something called a practice called prior authorization. A prior authorization refers to the practice of requiring a prescriber, a physician or a clinic or a hospital, to get prior approval or to call a state agency and say, we're going to prescribe this particular medication. And that practice is used to really try to influence prescribers to direct them towards more cost-effective medications. The drug manufacturers hate the practice of prior authorization because it is extremely effective in influencing prescribers. Typically in physician offices, if they know to prescribe drug A versus drug B, if they're both equally good in terms of their efficacy, but if they have to get prior approval for one versus the other, they will invariably move toward prescribing the drug for which they don't have to get prior approval. Well, the drug manufacturers hate to have their drugs subjected to that practice. They've challenged it in the courts. They challenged the state of Florida and the federal courts. The courts upheld the right of states to do that. They challenged Michigan. The courts again upheld it. They've been unable to stop it, the practice of prior authorization per se. In the case of Maine, they went and they got an injunction against the law saying for the state to be able to use prior authorization in the Medicaid program in order to further the interests of people who are outside of Medicaid, in this case those 300,000 people I referred to without drug insurance. The drug companies argued that this was an impermissible use of Medicaid and would threaten Medicaid recipients. The trial court in Maine, a federal court, agreed with the drug manufacturers, but we, the state, went to the Federal Court of Appeals in Boston, and we prevailed in a marvelous opinion by the First Circuit Court of Appeals, in which they quoted Justice Brandeis in that famous quote where he was the first person to articulate the states as laboratories of change, where he said, in our course of federalism, you can have a federal law one way, but states, the framers of our Constitution wanted states to be laboratories for change. So we won twice in the Court of Appeals. That's when the manufacturers appealed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that decision just now, about 2 weeks ago, was a great victory in our view, not just for people in Maine, but for people across the country, for people here in the state of Iowa, for really citizens right across the U.S., because some 28 states filed friend of the court briefs with Maine on those issues.
So you're saying that in the court system, the drug, the trade group for the pharmaceutical industry was arguing that it was going to inconvenience Medicaid patients?
So yeah, they invariably come at that. They try to say that if you prior authorize any drugs in Medicaid, it will threaten Medicaid patients.
So does the pharmaceutical industry have a big history of being an advocacy group for Medicaid patients, or is this
not
is this
really
a tactic?
I think it's very disingenuous, but it's something thought up in their bunkers, I guess. I don't think they have an authentic concern about Medicaid, other than recognizing it is one of the most lucrative areas of payment for medications. And as far as I know, the Medicaid program nationally is the biggest single purchaser of medications.
Now, aside from the pharmaceutical industry, was there significant opposition among other groups within the state of Maine, like the doctors or the hospitals?
There was not. There was not. The doctors were the doctors formally, I should say, the medical association was ambivalent or somewhat uneasy about using the weapon of prior authorization, and they were on the public record in that regard. Yet, at the same time, they were supportive on the public record as well of the Maine RX program. And I know physicians in general, and Maine has about 4,000 prescribers, about 3,000 physicians and another 1,000 or so clinic and nurse practitioners and others. The vast majority of prescribers are fine with it. They did not object to it. They recognized that the state was trying to do was trying to basically obtain access to medications for many thousands of people who should be taking medications but who can't because they can't afford them. The rationale in the court, the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals recognized Maine's rationale and Maine's argument. Our argument for and our the basis for which we wanted to justify using Medicaid to pressure the drug companies was this. We know, for example, in the United States, through medical studies, there are millions of Americans who should be taking cholesterol-lowering drugs day in, day out for the rest of their life, the so-called statin drugs. The statin drugs are very highly effective. They've been around for a decade or so. Here's the downside. They're expensive. And if your cholesterol is high, you may not feel bad at all, yet it's a ticking time bomb for putting you at risk of either a heart attack or a stroke, something severely debilitating. And our argument was, to the extent that we can make, for example, the statin drugs more accessible financially to the tens of thousands in Maine who should be on them, who aren't on them, then we will keep them healthier longer, so that they won't need a full Medicaid benefit. And that was the rationale we used. The court understood it. The U.S. Supreme Court understood it. People understand it from a common sense point of view. But the manufacturers, of course, will do whatever they could to try to block Maine, because they could tolerate Maine. Maine's a very small, population base in terms of a whole country. But they knew full well that many states across the country we're looking to Maine's lead. And
well, let's get to that. Do you know what other states are actually planning on imitating that type of program?
Well, Hawaii was the first one. There were two laws that we passed in Maine. One was called Maine RX, and the other one was called Healthy Maine Prescriptions. And Hawaii, I went out to Hawaii and testified at their legislature in both houses, and they enacted their two laws are called Hawaii RX and Healthy Hawaii Prescriptions. They are virtually the same as the two main laws. I know Washington State is another state that had variants on our theme, and Iowa, this state, has filed legislation in the last session, again, very similar to Maine's. Many states were sort of put on hold because the lobbyists for pharma went around to legislators saying, oh, no, you're going to have to spend a lot of money on litigation because, that Maine case is up in the Supreme Court. So it had the effect across the country of shelving a lot of those efforts, of putting them on, a side rail, waiting to see the outcome of this court decision. Now that the court has decided, I think clearly you'll see more states kind of pushing forward in this regard.
And the magnitude of discounts that you're expecting to achieve is around 25%, you said?
20 to 25% on typical name brand drugs, and more in the case of generics, higher discounts in the case of generics.
Kevin, do you anticipate any tactics the drug industry still may have available to avoid giving in on this, or is MaineRx really likely to be implemented as is?
Well, I certainly hope MaineRx is going to be implemented, but I don't in any way underestimate the tenacity of the drug manufacturers. They have large staffs of lawyers, and they sue each other routinely to delay, for example, the introduction of generics. So they're equal opportunity in the sense of their willingness and desire to sue states to block, even if they know inevitably they're going to lose. So I don't in any way assume they won't try once again to put up more roadblocks. However, having now a decision, 6-3 from the highest court in the land, I think finally the balance has shifted over to give states the freedom and the momentum that they need. Now, the companies, as we've seen recently when Glaxo, one of the largest in the world, threatened to stop shipping their medications into the country of Canada because they saw drugstores, drug companies at the retail level in Canada shipping into the U.S., that same company, when MaineRx was passed, announced that they would no longer ship medications into the state of Maine to their wholesaler, and that panicked people initially. And that caused me at that time to go out and take out a license in our state as a prescription pharmaceutical distributor, probably the only state human service agency in the country that has such a license. Fortunately, we never had to use it, but I wanted to demonstrate to the manufacturers that we would not be deterred by that kind of action. And no other companies followed suit when they saw, again, that we were determined, as I said at the time, if we had to send the National Guard down the interstate to Massachusetts or Connecticut to the wholesaler warehouses, we would do so. Well, back to your basic question, will the drug manufacturers try to retaliate, in so many words, against Maine by either withdrawing from Maine or charging a different price? They really can't do that. This is one of the interesting side effects of the national contract into which the manufacturers enter. They enter into a national contract with Medicaid, and they don't do it because their desire is to give a better break financially to states. They enter into this national contract because, one, they know Medicaid is now the single largest source of purchasing of medications, and two, they get what I describe as a Faustian sort of deal in this regard, because the states are prohibited from prohibiting the use of their medications. That is, states are not allowed under current law in this national agreement to actually institute what is a very strict formulary. And as you know, in the strictest sense, a formulary could absolutely outright prohibit the use of a particular drug. In Medicaid, you cannot. You can subject those medications to prior authorization, but you cannot prohibit the use of that medication. And that's the exchange that the manufacturers get for then agreeing to give this discount back to the states. Now, as much as Maine and states like Michigan, I suspect, although it's a much larger state, but Maine, I'm sure, is nettlesome and an irritant to the manufacturers. They're not going to withdraw from Maine because to withdraw from Maine, they must withdraw from the national Medicaid program. That is, from all 55 states and territories. They're not going to do that.
Well, Kevin Concannon, I really want to congratulate you on your efforts for the state of Maine.
Well, thank you.
I think that Iowa is lucky to have you there. Thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Great talking to you, Marvin.
There's an old saying that no news is good news. And today's report from Afghanistan certainly was not a cheerful tale of victory in the domain of public health. There have been successes, but a long road lies ahead. But also on today's show, we definitely have heard some good news. The World Health Organization, the public health branch of the United Nations, approved the Tobacco Control Treaty. This achievement was only made possible because of untiring efforts of public health activists across the globe. Credit also goes to diplomats and government workers in many countries. As a consequence of this treaty, over the next several years, fewer young people will take up the tobacco habit due to the anti-tobacco educational activities, smoking bans, and higher tobacco taxes the treaty will make possible. So years from now, fewer middle-aged people in many nations across the globe will be short of breath due to emphysema, and fewer people will be dying prematurely of heart disease and cancer. This is exactly what the United Nations is there for. The staff at the World Health Organization did not accept the inevitability of huge tobacco conglomerates penetrating what they consider to be untapped markets, the populations in the poor countries of the global south. And after years of persistence and patient effort, public health activists across the globe successfully persuaded the governments of the 170 nations across the globe to insist on a strong, meaningful agreement. And we described another success on today's show. The effort by Kevin Concannon and his colleagues in the state of Maine is a similar story. Persistent, dogged work, in this case against one of the most powerful and wealthy industries in the world, led finally to what really does look like a success. Both these efforts will lead to tangible, measurable benefits to the public health. But as is so typical with victories in the field of public health, in both cases the benefits to health will only be seen in statistics we can measure years from now. When drug prices drop 25%, there really will be people for whom that amount of money makes a difference. These people really will be able to buy and take life-saving medications, such as blood pressure medicines, and, as Kevin mentioned in his piece, cholesterol-lowering medications. Years from now, hundreds, perhaps thousands of individuals who might have otherwise suffered premature deaths, heart attacks, or disabling strokes will not suffer those events, but instead will be able to live many more years of healthy life without enduring needless limitations on their ability to live life to its fullest. It's true that there will be people who still can't afford their medicines and other people who can't be persuaded to take their medicine. And of course, millions of people without health insurance can't afford to go to the doctor in the first place, so they may never get the prescription to start with. But nonetheless, this is a victory, and it's not a small one. The states may soon have a venue to achieve even larger discounts off drug prices, so the situation may improve further. And another group of activists is addressing the issue of why generic drugs are priced needlessly high. In some ways, the efforts of Kevin Concannon and his colleagues in Maine directly contradicts the stereotype so many anti-government ideologues articulate throughout our media. Government bureaucrats are portrayed as complacent, unproductive individuals who go to work to make some money, get good benefits, and accomplish little. But in public health, rather than accepting the status quo, pushing for change in ways that can improve health is what we should expect from government officials. And this is exactly what we got from Kevin and his group in Maine. The voters of Maine elected a government which was committed to improving access to prescription drugs. That government took its mandate seriously, worked doggedly, and refused to be intimidated by even the wealthiest, most powerful lobbyists in the country, and won a major battle for the public health. Kevin Concannon and his team deserve to be honored for their effort. But chances are they won't win any awards or even much recognition. That's often the case in public health. The reward has to come from the knowledge that more citizens of Maine will be able to live longer and healthier lives without sacrificing hard-earned money and life savings because now they will be able to afford their medicine. Maybe that's enough of a reward. So let's celebrate the fine achievements of the World Health Organization and the Health Department of the state of Maine. It's great getting some good news. And let's extend the achievement. The next step will be for concerned active citizens in all the other 49 states to push our state governments to enact and implement the Maine program in their very next legislative session. I ask my listeners to write your state legislators and your health department today and tell them that we expect no less an achievement that what Maine now has in place. Let's make sure that this public health success will be rapidly contagious. And maybe this success will finally embolden state legislatures to take on the health insurance industry and actually implement statewide universal health care systems rather than just talk about it for another 50 years. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.